Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and next up we have a writer, and this sounds exciting. We've got... Now, what do we call this? This is crime fiction, maybe. We will talk to her and find out. So the book we're going to be focusing on is The Scorpion Scheme, Death and Danger on the Nile. And who's with us is the author, Melissa Yee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Al and Dave.
So,
and I would call it medical thriller.
Medical thriller, yeah, because I saw that on the bio, and that's why I didn't know what to call it, because that's not something I've really come across, though it, in a way it should be, because there is a lot of medical-based thrillers out there, right? So that's...
It's true. It's its own subgenre, but in this case, because Dr. Hoxie is going to Egypt, and she's spending the whole time in Cairo, it's not as hospital-based as some of the other books. It's more an international thriller.
Okay, so it's kind of a... So we kind of call it a thriller, but there is a medical part to it. But you bring in Egypt as well, so you've got a little bit of ancient history and all that in there. So this is a really new for me. We haven't really interviewed a lot of people that have done this sort of thing, so this is really interesting. How did you put this all together? Like, where does it come from for you?
Well, in real life, I'm an emergency doctor, and I always wanted to be a writer too. You know, like, ever since I was in kindergarten, I thought, I love books, you know, I love to tell stories. I want to do that with the rest of my life, but... I was really worried about not being able to eat and have a roof over my head. And I was good at school, and I liked helping people, so I thought medicine would be a really fun career, and I would get stories out of it, too. So I went into medicine, and it was totally true. I just underestimated how much energy it would take to be a doctor. So, you know, I have to short out on sleep sometimes to get it all done. But one of the things that I did get was... a travel company reached out to me and asked me if I would write novels in exchange for writing novels for them. Sorry, if I would travel around the world in exchange for writing for books for them. And I went to Ecuador and the Galapagos first, and then I went to Egypt second. And I said, you know, I need to write my own book about Egypt. I just feel like it's calling me. I don't know enough about it and the politics and ancient history and the pharaohs. I've got to do a deep dive into this and bring my main character to. And so that's how I started writing Scorpion's King.
Well, that's interesting. So I can see the medical part of it. I mean, you're dealing with it, especially in emergency. What made you choose Egypt? Like, what about Egypt that makes you want to write a book where it's based?
I know, it's funny, right? Because I was not one of the people who was really fascinated with Tutankhamun and or wanting to dress up like that for Halloween. It wasn't a big draw to me. But when I went there and I was looking at thousands of years of history, like, for example, when I landed shortly after that, we were visiting the Valley of Kings and Queens, and I was just walking into people's tombs and looking at the hieroglyphics and thinking, I wish I knew what this was saying. I'm sure it would mean so much if I had any idea. And in fact, in those tombs, the guide is not supposed to come with you. I think it's partly because it's somewhat of a narrow passageway, and they don't want to have tour groups blocking them. And also, it used to be a huge problem when there are lots of tourists, just the dampness, like the humidity, from people exhaling on the paintings on the wall, basically, were eroding them. So you're supposed to go in, take pictures if you paid for the permit to do so, and leave. But I thought, there's a whole other level here that I'm not getting, and I would really like to know more. In fact, I'm sure a lot of your listeners would understand that. You know, like, just be like, you're basically staring at a mystery the entire time, and you wish you could translate it.
Oh, totally. It's such a, and it's so complex. There's so many levels and so many stories about that whole, the whole existence of the Egyptians back then and what happened in that. So it's pretty amazing.
But, mm-hmm. And, oh, if I was just going to add, and what I thought was interesting too was just the culture was really different. Like, when you became a pharaoh, one of the first things you would do would be to decide your tomb. So, you know, what part of the Book of Dead would you want to have engraved on the walls? You know, how would you want it constructed? Where would it be located? That sort of thing. You would plan for your death immediately, and, you know, it would take up a good part of your life. So it's the opposite of modern-day North America, where the focus is just live, 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 and, you know, when people die, everyone's worried about talking about it and feels really kind of tiptoes around it. Whereas in Egypt, it was part of your life and worshiping your ancestors too, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Things have changed. So.
Yeah. I thought the years, things have changed.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of a different concept. But to put together a book like this, it must take a lot of time. Like, because you really have to get it right when you're talking about something like, you know, ancient Egypt and you're talking about pharaohs. You have to make sure that it's within the realm of truth, you know.
Yeah, you want it to be as accurate as possible. Yeah, I thought it was a challenging on so many levels. So when I went, you know, first of all, my brother said to me, don't go, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't actually know the Muslim Brotherhood. Like, I knew so little about Egypt. It was, maybe that made it easier for me to go. But when I started researching modern politics, I was like, you know, I didn't have a good idea what happened during Arab Spring. I don't know how they changed presidents from Mubarak to, his name is Hosni, to now LCC, you know, and what that means for the average person. And I would hear really contradictory things, you know, this person was good, this person was bad, this person was a puppet. And it was just hard to sort that out. And at the same time, I wanted to delve into ancient Egypt, which is what people here are more familiar with, and I wanted to get it right. So when I was listening to, for example, Kara Cooney talking about ancient Egypt, and she said that the closest modern equivalent that she could think of was North Korea, to have such a totalitarian government, you know, with a lot of iconography, basically, and absolute power. And I thought, no one had ever explained that to me before. That, you know, the reason why we have such lasting monuments today is because so much wealth and power went into building that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I think a lot of people don't realize that. And as far as them talking about, you know, this person was good and this one was bad, you can never tell. I think you're doing better going back in time because all we do know, the facts at the end of the day, are how people lived, you know, what happened to them, their experiences, right? Because that's the only fact we can really know, whether their leaders were good or bad, or the people around us, just all sort of, you know, it's feeling and opinion. But the fact is, how do people live? And I'm sure they'll say that about today's times and all the things we're doing now in 100 years. They could say all sorts of things about our leaders.
Yes, true.
Right? And there will be all sorts of stories that come through. But but to find out real fact, all they could do is look at what we actually did in our day-to-day lives, right? So that's kind of the key thing. So when you put characters into this situation like this, where do your characters come from?
So Dr. Hopesee is based on me during my residency. So she's 27. She has been in school pretty much her whole life. And, you know, as far as she's concerned, she'd just like to get a good mark, get out of here, become an emergency doctor. But for some reason, what the fiction part of it is that she keeps encountering killers and trying to figure out, and basically she can't leave anybody behind. So if somebody comes to her and says, could you help me? She always says yes, and that ends up with her tangled in a lot of different problems. In this case, for going to Egypt, my tour group was at the pyramids when they heard, an explosion, basically. So the ground shook and they could hear the boom. And one of them said, what is that? And the tour guide said, oh, nothing, and just hastily brought them away. And it wasn't until later that they heard through the news that there was a bomb outside the new Egyptian museum that had taken out a bus with South Africans. People were injured but not killed. And for myself, I wasn't there at the time. My son was having his birthday, so I was taking a later flight, and I ended up missing that bomb entirely. I also missed the pyramids, but that's another story. And when I was writing this book, I ended up rewriting the beginning to incorporate that, because obviously it's a dramatic beginning. And it does happen. It's not common, but you know, terrorism can be part of that day-to-day life. So when I was meeting everyday Egyptians, I would ask them, I said, wow, you know, there was a bomb. What do you think? And, you know, one of them said to me, well, nobody was killed. They weren't professionals, so that was good. And another one said, well, you know how you have school shootings in America? Here we have bombs.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. You know, so there were a lot of different reactions to it, but, you know, to some extent it also becomes normalized because, you know, it's not unheard of to have that happen. And, you know, I wanted Hope to get in there and try to save somebody's life. And in this case, when I started researching South Africa, because it was South Africans on the real bus that was affected in May 2019, I started researching treasure. Like in my mind, I thought it would be really fun if she went on a treasure hunt instead of just people killing each other, because especially during the pandemic, we're kind of sick of that. Yeah. And I found the Kruger Millions. I didn't realize that there was this whole legend about Paul Kruger, one of the presidents, like one of the first leaders of South Africa, and that he might have hidden gold that would now be worth $500 million. And I was like, wow, that would be a really interesting thing for her to go off to Egypt and happen upon that. So that was the beginning of how I started writing that novel.
So when would you, during this process and you're writing this, when do you know it's time that you're finished? Like with such a broad, there's so many things going on in the story. How do you know where to end it and to send it in to the publisher?
I guess every book is different, of course, but in this case, I ended up cutting it short, actually. So one story that I was going to include was about a girl who was attacked on a bus, that was a true case, and I was just going to fictionalize it and include it in my story. She survived, and she's okay. I hope it's okay if I tell your listeners, and maybe you can just bleep this out if it's not. But in the real story, what happened was she was on a minibus. The bus driver asked everybody else to get off, and she was, I think, maybe 13. Like, she was very young. And so she was alone with the bus driver, and he said he would take her home because the bus was having mechanical problems. He couldn't do everybody, but he would take care of her. And then he took out a knife and tried to sexually assault her. And she took the knife and killed him. So obviously that was a huge case. And the hashtag Justice for Amira was trending on Twitter. So I was kind of writing and leading up to that the entire novel. And I had written the scene where Hope comes across her and coming off the bus and everything like that. And then I just stopped. Like, there was, I kept skipping over that scene. And finally I realized that I didn't want to write it or read it. I found it too tough for right now during the pandemic and everything like that. So that scene's not in the book. So I ended up having to rearrange the rest of the book and modify the plot and that sort of thing. But afterwards, I felt good about it. You know, I just wanted a more lighthearted tale. You know, in this one, I'm very proud of the fact that, for example, Hope and her fiancé, Tucker, go out and eat shawarma, and they're walking through the night with juice dripping down their arms, and they're sipping on mango juice and pomegranate juice. And, you know, I wish I could be there with them, and I'm sure everybody else does too. So I just feel like I can bring longing and fun instead of horror.
I guess you have to be very careful because you're dealing, you know, being a doctor and you're dealing with a medical thriller and stuff like that, and also with current affairs. So, you know, like with what happened to Amir and stuff, you have to really decide what you're going to include, right? Because with the pandemic, you have to be careful about what you do with the medicine sort of thing and what's going on in the world and all that stuff. It must be a real difficult thing.
It is a juggling act. And I felt more of a responsibility for this book set in Egypt because I was posting when I was traveling there in 2019. And one of my colleagues afterwards thanked me. She was from Egypt. And she said, thank you for showing this side of Egypt and basically for portraying the Middle East in a positive way, which we don't usually see in Western media.
Right.
And but, I thought, oh, no, but I'm actually writing a thriller, so there has to be crime. So it has to be a balance between trying to be respectful and show the really wonderful parts about Egypt and North Africa, but also being realistic and showing some crime that did happen.
Well, yeah, in America, with the media, has got a huge, they're mass media, right? What were they called last week? Bulldozer by one of our guests. And well, in a sense that, you know, they have an idea of what, let's say, Egypt is or the Middle East, and it's presented that way in 1,000 shows a week type thing. It just kind of gets thrown out there, and we all see it, so we all get exposed to it, and so we just accept that as true. But when you go to a lot of these countries, you realize that it's not anything like that, there's so much more to it. Because that would be like just saying, you know, America, you know, has a mass shooting every day, and then all of a sudden that's all you think about. So don't go there, you get shot. If that would be the same kind of premise, right? So.
Yes, and I think we all feel that way. Like, this will be my own ignorance. Like, when I went to Oregon to a writing conference, people were introducing themselves to each other. And they were saying, oh, you know, I'm from Massachusetts. Oh, I'm from Florida. Oh, my aunt is from Florida. And they were chatting away about it. And I was puzzled because, you know, I'm from Canada. And I thought, well, you're all American. To me, like, they would just sort of bond about they were all American. And then we would go on from there. But it just helped me realize that the U.S. is such a vast country that you're looking to find kinship in different areas. So... Now that I've traveled a bit more too, I see it. You know, there's a lot of difference between East Coast, West Coast, you know, the heartland, North, South, you know, and that's the pleasure of traveling and meeting people.
Yeah. And that has two sides to it, because it's like there's the 50 states, it's like 50 countries. They each have their own personality and culture and style, and that works great in one side because you do have such diversity, but in the other one, it's like when times are tough, it separates people. So it kind of works both ways, which is unfortunate because it should be they're all the same. Right, it should be a bigger picture, but you know. No.
Yeah, we see that too in Canada because healthcare is delivered provincially, just like yours would be be sent out by state, and you see the differences. You know, some provinces have more money than others. Some have better access to vaccines than others. Just for example.
Yeah, yeah, I'm still waiting.
Yeah, I only have my first dose anyway.
Well, you know, let's get on that, hey? What are you doing?
Yes,
you're spending too much time writing and not getting vaccines.
Hey,
to
I'm
me.
Doing three vaccine clinics the next 3 days, just so you know.
Yeah, and so you did you find this whole last year and a half, I guess I should say, of all the turmoil, like, you know, more so in the U.S. with Trump and all the that sort of unrest and Black Lives Matters and all the things going on. And it, of course, it goes over into Canada, but plus the pandemic and things like that. Did that affect your ability to write?
Yes. So for me, it started with COVID and just feeling like I really wanted to try and make sure that my hospital was as prepared as it could be and that its policies made sense. You know, so then I was talking to administration and saying, you know, we really have to cut visitors. We really need to make sure that people who are trying to travel for March break don't just come back and spread. And that sort of thing that sounds like common sense now, but at the time they were just like, no, it's fine. It's fine as long as you don't go to Italy or Spain or Iran, you know, and I'm like, or China. I'm like, clearly not, you know, and so now we know that the first viruses that came in Canada were from New York, for example. So that took a lot of headspace, and I'm just trying to figure out the medically what was going on, because, you know, nobody knew anything. It was just people trying to work on the fly. So someone would be working in ICU in Italy, and then they would send it to their friend, and then those friends would post it in a group that we were in, and we were just trying to decipher, okay, yes, use steroids, no, don't use steroids, you know, and, you know, yes, clotting is a problem, heparinize everybody, you know, so we're trying to go through that. And one of the things that I did was I wrote a petition just asking for PPE was my main thing. I wanted to make sure that we had enough because, you know, we would literally see doctors dying in Italy because they didn't have any gloves, let alone any other protective equipment. So I was like, Canada better wake up. So I wrote a petition and 61 of my colleagues signed it. And it actually got over 200,000 signatures. And I was talking to the media about that and how we were trying to, you know, do this warlike effort to stop COVID before it started here, because we were in a relatively luxurious position that we had less people traveling here and we could just watch it come rather than being on the first line. So that took at least a month out of my life and I didn't do much of anything else. And then when it came back to, then it was kind of, then I had this really complicated book that I was trying to struggle through. So for sure, COVID threw me off. Black Lives Matter, like, heartbreaking. We all felt it. And here we have Black people who are disproportionately affected as well as Indigenous people. So, you know, we tried to put our support there too. And for me, that meant donating money as well as speaking out.
It must be disappointing too, in a sense, for someone in your profession on the medical side to see people that are, you know, anti-maskers or saying that masks don't do anything and all the other stuff out there about the vaccines and things like that. With things like that, does that sort of get you kind of losing faith in people a little bit?
Yes, for sure. I mean, sometimes I talk to my husband and he just says, people are terrible. So I'm like, oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I just kind of summed it up. You know, I think it's kind of his way of curtailing any complaint, because you can just say people are terrible, and then you just have to stop and agree, and then there's nowhere else to go.
True. Well, I mean, and they can be. I mean, that's what I mean. So, because you're writing stories, and you're, you know, maybe I'm wrong here, but I would say that the stories have a lot of feeling and emotion, and it, mm-hmm. it's about relationships in a sense, right? Even though there's, you know, things going on during, you know, it's a thriller, mm-hmm. but so. That's kind of, you know, I'm tying this back to affecting you during writing. Yeah, so you're concentrating on the pandemic and stuff. But just that in itself, with people kind of going, well, you know, vaccines don't do anything, and it's fake, and don't wear masks and all the stuff like that. I would think that that would be kind of a little bit depressing, and therefore when you're trying to write your characters in a book like this, does that affect the way you write them? Do they become a little darker? Do they become a little less nice, you know?
Hmm. Well, I'm already not nice in some ways.
Well, then there we go. That's but, it. Kind of, so that makes a better book.
I try to live in my own little bubble a bit. So in this case, there is no pandemic in Egypt. You know, it's just an alternate universe where that's not happening. So that makes one thing easier. So they can just travel and they don't have to wear masks. And then the second thing would be, you know, I try to concentrate on the vast majority of people. You know, even at the beginning of the pandemic, I would go on Reddit and they would have things saying like 70% of Americans think we should lock down. You know, the majority of people were supporting it. But, you know, we can easily get swayed and just look at the minority who are very vocal and very dangerous and get disheartened by them. Luckily, I live in the country and I have smart Facebook friends. So for the most part, you know, I don't get the banging of pots and pans. You know, I was thinking about that today because, you know, we live on 12 acres, so there's nobody to bang pots and pans for me. But, you know, they would post on my Facebook feed, you know, like encouraging art and that sort of thing, you know, about doctors and nurses as heroes and that sort of thing. And I just use that to keep up my spirits. You know, you can look at, there's always glass half full, glass half empty. So I just try and concentrate on the good stuff, because if I let myself get dragged down with the bad stuff, I wouldn't keep going.
Yeah. My glass is broken, so I there's no full or empty or anything like that, you know. So other than the complex, the story parts and the things you've got going on in the book, at the end of the book when I read it, is there something else you want me to get from this book?
My name is Hope.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And actually, an English teacher pointed out to me that her last name is C, which sounds, you know, like, so it could be that she sees things clearly. So sometimes I put a quote in there about hope and how it seems impossible and in some ways unbelievable, but it's still possible to make a good world. Because really, mysteries and thrillers are about justice in the end. You find the bad, the culprit, and you put them away.
Dave, stop barking.
I'm so sorry. I'll put my dog in. She feels really strongly about your broken glass.
I guess I shouldn't have said that. I better not say that. Boy, I'll tell you, I'm getting into trouble. You were younger and you wanted to write and you always knew you could tell stories and do all that stuff. There must have been a point where you thought you could actually do it and felt brave enough. Because when you're writing these stories, and you talked about the one doctor who was kind of based on you when you were in residency. So, therefore, just like any of us who write, you do put some of yourself into every story. And so, therefore, because we're talking feelings, relationships, emotions, things that happen, we kind of expose ourselves when we write these stories. And therefore, putting it out there for everybody to see, and especially in today's world, right? You know, we've got such a intermixing social media world that it's easy to be judged. That's a nice way to say it.
So, it's so dangerous, even.
Yeah, so when you expose something about yourself, a way you feel, the way you believe in something, and you put it in your story and you put it out there, that takes a lot of courage, I think. It takes a lot of courage in these days, especially. How do you know what you can put, you can't put, and when you feel comfortable enough to put that, like that has to be, there has to be something that gives you that fire to do that, that ability to do that and kind of go, yeah, okay, I'm doing this.
I guess when I was little, I just read books and I thought, I can do better. I knew I could do better than that. You know, they always say that children's books are, you know, the best books, and they have to be, they have the most demanding audience. But if you just go through random children's books, you'll find a lot of bad ones. So I think that's what inspired me to just give it a try and say, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring sort of thing. And then for the criticism, because that's what really hurts.
Yeah.
I think that came more later. I mean, at the beginning, when you're writing, you're just getting rejected all the time, so nobody sees it. They may not respond, or they might just say, alas, this didn't meet our needs. And that doesn't give you a lot of feedback, but you don't take it necessarily that personally. It's later when your stories are out in the world and you start getting some personal feedback that can really stop you. So for me, it was actually one of my nonfiction books that took off on Amazon. It was a collection of essays called The Most Unfeeling Doctor in the World and Other True Tales from the Emergency Room. And that one was so popular that a person wrote hate mail and emailed it to me. One reviewer said, I wish I could burn this book, but it's an e-book, so I can't. I was like, okay, for me, they were kind of lighthearted essays about the emergency room. I didn't see why people were getting so upset. But that just kind of cut me off. Like, I just thought, I used to pour my heart into fiction and then use nonfiction to just kind of decompress and just write, ha ha, funny thing happened today, with some details changed. And now I'm like, man, I can't even write that without people getting really angry at me. But again, the majority of people were just quietly happy and buying it and didn't have any problem with it. But there was a really vocal minority that was furious. And I talked about it with my friends, you know. I posted the hate mail on Facebook, and one of my friends was like, that's not so much hate mail as wine mail. Because the person, I think, just right at the beginning and said that, and then I mentioned that I was busy. And he was like, how dare you be busy? You're a doctor. You're like, you should be just glad that you have a job. And I thought, but if I wrote about how I was really slow and had a lot of downtime, like, did anybody want to read about that? You know, it's just so strange. I mean, I just didn't respond. But, you know, basically my friends made me laugh about stuff, and I got over it. And in that case, I just wrote different things. So I just stopped writing nonfiction for a bit, and then I write mystery, science fiction, fantasy, romance, young adult. Like, I write all sorts of stuff. So I just switched over until those voices faded away. And in the end, I tried to develop what Karen Joy Fowler calls the pachydermal skin of a writer, which is you put stuff out, and then people say stuff, and it just bounces off your elephant skin. Sometimes now I read reviews, and I kind of laugh. I'm just like, whatever.
There are always haters.
Yes.
But you've won some prestigious awards, and you also, I want to talk about, just for a second, Writers of the Future, because I'm trying to win that right now. And
yes.
Best. And,
go for it. Yeah, for sure.
But I was just interested in your experiences with the content, the contest, and how long it took you to win.
Yeah, that's a great story. So my husband used to, he was my boyfriend at the time. He would buy Writers of the Future, and that's how I heard about the contest.
Ah, cool.
And I was like, wow, great idea. It's only open to people who've never been published before or only have a limit of 3 professional publications before you're too professional to enter it. You're not new anymore. So I was like, that's what I want to do. And there's no entry fee. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to enter. So I entered 2 or 3 times, and I got a postcard back saying thanks for your entry, and then you didn't win. And I was like, offended. And I stopped submitting. And then I did submit Skin Song, which is a story about a medical student who dissects a cadaver, but her special talent is that she hears noises, like she calls them skin songs, when she touches somebody's skin, and she doesn't know how that will be with a dead body. So I wrote that during my first year of medical school, and I was one of the winners for Writer of the Future in my last year of medical school. And when they got back to me and they called me and congratulated me, I was like, wow. And I went to so they fly you down to Los Angeles and you spend a week there learning about writing. And then they have a ceremony and they unveil the anthology and they pay you separately for the anthology as well as the winning. So it is totally worth submitting to, as long as you don't mind the fact that it's funded by L. Ron Hubbard's estate and Scientology. And when I went there, seriously, what I liked was, sorry, what was I going to say there? What I thought was really interesting was that one of the first place winners, it was his first try that he had won first place, and then that means you're up for the grand prize as well. His wife had applied quarter after quarter and year after year and hadn't placed. Yeah. So I was looking around and I realized, I was like, wow, the fact that I stopped applying only hurt me. It wasn't like Writers of the Future was sitting there going, I wonder what happened to Melissa. You know, they had no clue. They didn't care. And, they would just go through whatever thousands of entries they'd gotten that quarter. So the people I admired the most was not the gentleman who won on his first try, but the ones who had tried quarter after quarter. And, you know, it means that every 3 months you have a new story and you just get better and better.
Absolutely.
And I thought if I'm going to make a career out of writing, I can't get my nose out of joint, you know, because I feel like they're not seeing my uber talent. Right. I have to put the work in and put up with the rejection and just keep going and going. And that was one of the things that I took away. The other thing I took away from Writers of the Future was was a bit embarrassing, but I was really cheap and always really worried that writing would never pay the bills, right?
Yeah.
So we were across the street from a used bookstore, and I found this book called Poem Crazy, and it cost, it was still, to me, expensive. Like, it was over $10 American, because that's at least 30% more Canadian. And you get paired with one other writer during that week. So I talked to William Brown, my quote-unquote twin, and I was like, you know, there's a book, I really want it, but I don't know if I should spend any money on it. And he said, I think it was $16. And he was like, well, would you get $16 worth of pleasure out of it? And I said, yes. And then I bought it. And that was my other big realization, was that if I was going to get anywhere with writing, or really any sort of career, I was going to have to put money in and not be so afraid. Those were my big take-homes from Writers of the Future.
There you Excellent. Go, Dave.
Very interesting. You know. Do you prefer writing medical thrillers or fantasy and science fiction?
Well, it's like a mom answer. You know, I like both of them. So when I was doing especially residency, but med school and residency, really, I didn't write medical thrillers at all. So people would be like, why don't you be like Michael Crichton? And I'd be like, no. because I was working all the time. You know, it's not cute. It's not fun if you're just there 24 hours a day. It wasn't until I graduated from residency and even from my emergency year, like I had to completely graduate before I felt free in my mind enough to look at writing about medicine for fun. So I wrote a lot of fantasy and a little bit of science fiction during those years because they were really good at escape. So, for example, I have a series of stories called The Wizard Hospital stories. And in those, it's a hospital, but it's run by a wizard. And it's all magical creatures who come for help. And that was really fun for me. I'll help you, but only if you're magical.
Well, that's an American hospital. Yeah, you don't have the right insurance. When you look back at the work you've done, is there certain books that stand out for you?
Well, the Hope C series stands out because that's the one that I'm most recognized for. And I enjoy it because I can put a lot of my personality and put a lot of crazy medical cases in there too and develop that world. I guess also because it has 8 books and a radio play and some short stories as well. So it's my most developed world. But I still love my fantasy and science fiction too. Yeah. And I have other mystery series and everything. And I can't say no to my nonfiction because I write for the Medical Post every month and that pays some bills too. So again, like I can't choose, but I can tell you my theme. Because I took a course with Bob Meyer, and he said, what's your theme? I was like, oh, I write across so many genres, this is impossible. And I ended up telling him that it was smart outsiders who win. So all of my protagonists are intelligent, and they're never, you know, the cheerleader or the quarterback, that sort of person. They're always on the edge, but, you know, there's generally a happy ending. Because that's what I believe we all need, especially right now.
I would say so. is there any book that you'd go back and change?
I have changed a little bit the beginning of Code Blues, which is the first book in the Hope C series, because the first 3 books are mysteries. So their pace is slower. They're more gentle. There's a bit more romance in there. And if you see bad reviews, it's the people who are like, wow. I don't know what all this is, like all this love stuff. Where's the mystery, you know? So in that way, it's a little bit tough. So I have tried to add a little bit more tension to the beginning.
But that's interesting.
In the end, the nice thing is like nothing is set in stone. You know, books are mutable.
Well, yeah, they're digital.
Yeah.
Do you ever get a writer's block? And if you do, how do you get out of it?
So I had mentioned that when I was letting criticism gets in my head that did give me a writer's block. And also, when my daughter was born, I was really tired, just exhausted. You know, I would, I remember just emptying the dishwasher and thinking, it's a good thing I'm emptying the dishwasher and not working or writing, because this is all I'm good for. Like, there just weren't a lot of brain cells left. So in that case, what I did was I rewrote some fairy tales. And I said, you know, this is good. I don't have to come up with a plot. Plot's already set. I just have to, you know, work on the character and give it a twist. And so some of the things I did was I wanted to retell Cinderella. So I researched the Chinese version of Cinderella so I could delve into that a bit. And I rewrote Snow White in several different ways. And some of them have been published in Enchanted Conversation more recently. So those are my tips. If you're really fatigued, or if other people's voices get in your head, try and switch to something else. And also be gentle with yourself. Because I've also had writing blocks when, you know, something really terrible has happened in my life. And that's not the time that you're going to be writing necessarily great work. You really need to take care of yourself as a human being. You know, the words can always come later, but you need to take care of yourself, which is hard to remember both as a physician and as a writer, but is really important. And again, something that we might need to hear in the last year.
Well, yeah. What would you say to a new writer or a person that wants to be published and wants to become a writer, and what would you tell them the best advice is for them?
I'd say welcome. It's always wonderful for people to express themselves. You know, I don't think that people should start off thinking about money and fame. For example, like some of the doctors were joking about, you know, if they were going to quit medicine, what would they do? And some of them were like, I'll just write a book and get super famous and make so much money. And I was like, oh, sweeties. You know, some of them also joked about becoming drug dealers. And I thought, yeah, that's actually, if you want the money, that's actually a more realistic thing. So I say welcome, and just make sure that you read a lot and that books are something that you really love. So not everybody is called to literature. Like, I just love books. I read books every day. You know, I have books upstairs, downstairs, digitally, physical, everything. But some people, you know, for them it's more music or Netflix or something, you know, and just whatever or soap making, you know, it can be anything, but you should pick something that you really love. Some people write books because they hear that that's what you should be doing, but it should be something that you just adore. And if you do, then you do it for the love, and you just keep going and going, getting better and better. And eventually, ideally, it's like what somebody told me about acting. You know, at first, it's like getting on a bus, and the bus is so crowded. And you're just fighting, you can hardly squeeze in, and there's no seat for you, and it's so stressful. But as the bus keeps going on, and as you get better and better, you know, people get off, people get on, there's a bit more room. And you find a seat for yourself.
Or you kick the driver out and drive the bus off the mountain.
Sure, that's always an option, like mass suicide and homicide. You know what?
I'm writing true crime, real events. I write about murder, so you know, I'm throwing them off the bus.
Just immediately speed, but off a cliff. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, you throw them off the bus. Or if you can't get them off fast enough, that's when you put the brick on the gas and jump out and let it go over the cliff. Then no more competition.
Okay, yeah, just let them all die. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
No more.
That's too fine for sure.
Yeah, no more writer competition there.
If I could say something semi-seriously there, that is something I had to learn, like, and just total honesty.
What, driving a bus?
No, I wish I could. No, it was that I was always super envious of other writers. You know, like, I would act happy if somebody said it, but I didn't feel it, you know?
Right.
And I realized that was holding me back as well. That, you know, it's more a rising tide lifts all boats, and you can help each other. And wasting time on envy and jealousy, that's just going to sink you in the end. So
how do you get over that? But how did you get away from feeling that way?
Hmm.
Like if let's say you're writing.
I like to interview people. Like what you do. I just feel like, okay, let's talk about jealousy. And then I would file it away. And I just like, okay, all right, if I can try this and that. But I think more what I saw was just that people help each other. And that helped too. And also realizing that your audiences aren't all the same. Like my audience tends to be different. I think intelligent and not wanting just the same rehash or the same books that they've read before. But the vast majority of people want to read the same books over and over again. So if you realize you're not all directly competing for the same readers and the same dollars, that you can just be friends and trade tips and stuff, it's a much easier way to live.
Yeah, because my readers can't read.
So they listen to the podcast.
Yeah, they just buy the book because that's what they're supposed to do, and they can't read. That's
you know what? I'm actually okay with that. If they want to buy it for decoration or just as a support me and stuff, I'm like, thank you. That's awesome.
Buy it and burn it. I don't know. I just I'm terrible. Who are your inspirations then? Who sort of influences how you write?
I always think of Christine Catherine Rush first. So she and Dean Wesley Smith teach originally in Oregon and now they're in Las Vegas. And what I love about her is that she writes in all different genres. And like, so for example, she had a lot of success with one series, the Smokey Dalton mystery series, under the name Chris Nelscott. And so I was like, wow, don't you want to just double down on Smokey and that's where you're going to go? And she said, no, I really need to write one of my sweet romances after I finish every Smokey Dalton book. So she was the first person I met who wrote widely, you know, was super good with feedback and anyway, like just, and I admire her writing as well, especially the Smokey Dalton series. So she's one of the people who really inspires me. Another ones for mystery would be Dina Stabenow, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who writes the Kate Shugak mystery set in Alberta. I'm sorry, not Alberta, in Alaska. She's American. It's further north and further west, yeah. Sorry about that, Dana. But there are, and actually for FNSF, one of the people I like is Jim Drusen. The Drusen Files are a lot of fun.
Right, yeah.
Mysteries, but with a giant wizard. And Charlene Harris, too. So, I mean, there are just so many people who are amazing. I just love reading.
Yeah. Should read Dave Martino's book. Incredible.
Yeah, for sure.
It should be on the top of your list. You should have one on each floor of your house. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
One of my friends took a picture and he had piled up all of his books and it was taller than him.
Yeah.
So I could just do that with Dave Martino's books.
Yeah.
You guys get all of them, make it taller than me. I'm not that tall, so it wouldn't be that hard.
Yeah, I'm the same. Yeah. I'm very short. So.
Very short.
Very short.
Short, short. Yeah.
Short. And,
yeah. Are you 5'2", though? Cause
I am.
Are you? Okay.
5'2½", and I need that half.
Yeah, I would tell people I was 5'2¼", and they would always laugh at me. Yeah. I'm serious. I'm like, it's 158 centimeters. It's an extra centimeter.
That's a great height.
It sounds so big. It does. 158.
That's true. Actually, just converted to metric, you know.
Yeah. 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 Especially in America, they go, wow, she's 158. That must be tall.
Mm-hmm. I'll just pound all of the people who leave bad reviews.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we can't worry about those. So how do people get a hold of you? So you have a Facebook page, but you have a website as well. And
So my Facebook page is Melissa Yee Yunennis. And so it has, so Melissa Yee is a pseudonym that I use, and then also Yuan-Innes. And I have my website where if you subscribe to my newsletter, you get a free Hope C novella. So please do that, and that's at www.myi.ninja. So that's easier to remember. And I'm also on Twitter, at @Dr_Sassy.
Well, there we go. Now, we're going to have that up on our website as well, so people that are listening can go and find you one click. And please send all of your hate mail and bad advice there. Not to the station and not to us. We're here for the good. And Melissa loves all of that stuff. She just lives for it. Okay.
So. Me and my pachydermal skin just love it.
That's what you have to have to make it in writing. Are you going to write forever now? Do you think this is something you want to do now as far as you can go?
For sure. I just told somebody I'm going to write until I die or I lose my marbles.
Well, I was going to say in the medical profession, that's not going to be long, right? I mean, it must be the same.
The timeline's getting shorter.
Yeah, it goes fast. Well, it's certainly been a pleasure. We've enjoyed your company for the hour. And, of course, the new book, The Scorpion Scheme, and that's Death and Danger on the Nile, is the new book by our guest, author Melissa Yee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Al and Dave.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, guys.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.